WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we continue Animal Week with creatures that give you the creeps. Entomologist David Brody shares his adventures rounding up cockroaches in bat caves for the film Creepshow. E.O. Wilson, who's been called Mr. Ant, tells us how ants let each other know that the action's in your kitchen. Harry Green describes how snakes inject their venom. And Wayne Grady explains how vultures can stomach dead and decaying flesh. Animal Week continues on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. U.S. warplanes have clashed with Iraqi forces for the second time this week. Major Joe LaMarca, a spokesman for the U.S. Central Command in Tampa, said U.S. and British fighter jets were conducting a routine patrol of the southern no-fly zone when the Iraqis fired between 6 and 8 surface-to-air missiles. He said the U.S. planes responded by firing 2 missiles and dropping a number of precision-guided munitions. LaMarca said the pilots are always on guard.
I think it's important to note that any time an aviator gets into his airplane to go patrol and fly the no-fly zone missions, they realize the nature of it is it's very serious business, and so they're always prepared, always at a high state of alert.
LaMarca said the planes returned safely to base. On Monday, U.S. planes fired on an Iraqi position in the northern no-fly zone after coming under missile attack. Western tourists freed in Yemen say their compatriots were killed yesterday after security forces attacked the Islamic militants who had held the 16 captives. Dale Gavlak reports from Cairo.
Survivors from the Yemeni kidnapping ordeal say their captors tried to use them as human shields. They say half of the 16 hostages wound up in the middle of a 2-hour gun battle after government troops fired on the militants trying to escape with some of their captives. The Islamic militants shot 2 of the hostages in revenge as they tried to flee their stronghold south of the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. 3 Britons and an Australian were killed Tuesday. 2 women, an American and a Briton, were wounded in the attack. Yemeni officials said one of the militants arrested was the group's leader. He's an Egyptian wanted by Cairo for his extremist activities. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak in Cairo.
Communities in the Pacific Northwest are bracing for more flooding today from this week's heavy rains. The Red Cross is preparing to open shelters east of Seattle as several rivers rise to flood stage. Ingrid Lobet of member station KPLU has more.
People in lower-lying areas in the eastern foothills of the Cascade Mountains are being asked to evacuate their homes in anticipation of flooding on several streams. In another area, the county north of Seattle, major flooding is said to be imminent on the Snohomish River. There has been improvement in some areas. Residents forced to leave a nursing home 2 days ago are being allowed to return, and the Weather Service has canceled flood warnings on several streams. Also, communities across Oregon are getting a reprieve from the rain and rising rivers. The National Weather Service is predicting most rivers will crest below flood stage. For NPR News, I'm Ingrid Lobet in Seattle.
The population of the United States grew by more than 2.5 million this year. The Census Bureau is estimating next year's growth to be about 2.3 million. On Wall Street, at the current hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 33 points in moderate trading. On the NASDAQ, the composite index is down just over 9 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, although the Dow is down, the broader market is narrowly mixed in the next-to-last trading session of the year. Government regulators have approved the merger of Amoco and British Petroleum. The Federal Trade Commission gave its blessing to the $57 billion corporate marriage after the companies agreed to sell off some gas stations and allow hundreds of others out of their supply contracts. Federal regulators have given approval to British Petroleum's acquisition of Amoco. It's a move that may encourage more mergers in the oil industry, as NPR's David Wellner reports from Chicago.
The Federal Trade Commission gave unanimous approval for the BP-Amoco merger. Valued at nearly $57 billion, it's one of the biggest deals ever in the oil industry, and it creates the country's third-largest oil firm, which will be known as BP-Amoco. The merger was first announced last August, and it was followed by an even bigger deal announced by Exxon to acquire Mobil Oil. That merger, which has not yet been approved by regulators, raised questions about whether the historic antitrust breakup of Standard Oil early this century was being reversed. To win regulators' approval, BP and Amoco agreed to sell off 9 light petroleum products terminals and 134 gas stations. That's less than 0.5% of the two companies' 27,000 outlets, which account for more than a quarter of the country's filling stations. David Wellner, NPR News, Chicago.
The price of gold in London at the afternoon fixing was $287.80 an ounce. That's up a dollar from the morning fixing. The index of leading indicators rose 0.6% in November, exceeding analyst estimates. The widely followed economic gauge suggests continued economic strength well into the new year. The index designed to forecast economic activity 6 to 9 months in advance. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Animal Week on Fresh Air, and today we have a parade of creatures that give you the creeps, starting with one of the creepiest of them all, the cockroach. We have an interview with former bug wrangler Dave Brody. Cockroaches in your home are never a welcome sight. In one film role, E.G. Marshall had a real problem.
Once you get bugs, you never get rid of them. Breed in the crawl spaces, in the conduits, in the very core of the building itself.
In the film Creepshow, E.G. Marshall played a millionaire, Howard Hughes-type hermit, whose germ-free penthouse was mysteriously infested by cockroaches. These roaches were supplied and handled by entomologist Dave Brody. In Hollywood parlance, he was known as a bug wrangler. In the film The Believers, he worked with tarantulas and centipedes. But his tour de force was directing more than 20,000 cockroaches for Creepshow. Brody is now the senior museum technician in the Department of Entomology at the Museum of Natural History in New York. In 1987, I asked him how he rounded up the Creepshow roaches, including 2,000 giant roaches from Trinidad.
I made some calls to Washington, and I found out that if I was very careful, I can import the giant cave roach from Trinidad. They flew us to Trinidad, and you would sit on the floor of the cave, and the cave floor was covered in bat guano, bat droppings. Now, because the cave was dry, these droppings had the consistency of coffee beans. You would sit down on the floor with your legs crossed, and the ground, the coffee beans would undulate because beneath them were the roaches. And we got about 2/3 of the roaches that we needed out of that. And then we went down to the lower cave, and that was a very wet cave, very disturbing cave because it was narrow and constricting. And there was one point within that cave where you really had to wiggle through. And that's when the bats left that cave, they made a slight drop in their flight path, and that's where they defecated. So you had water dripping there. Now, coming out of the cave after collecting the roaches, my hand sort of slipped into that morass, and I wanted to amputate my hand at that point. It was very, very unpleasant.
The name that you're given when you work on a movie is Roach Wrangler or Tarantula Wrangler.
Mm-hmm.
Why is the word wrangler used?
That's
for your line
that's
of work?
A movie term. Horse wranglers, cow wranglers, and it sort of just trickled down. But I think it's a good term. I think it's exactly what we do.
How do you control roaches on a set? If they're actors, you tell them what their positions are, and you yell positions, and everything's all set. How do the roaches know where their positions are?
You build corrals for them, and you give the impression that they're doing things. And you can get them to move in directions by air current, by light. The very things that govern their lives, essentially, is how we use them. The scenes where they're coming up out of the sink were done with giant plastic syringes, and we just sort of pumped them in. My favorite scene in that movie was, of course, the bed scene, when he flips the covers off the bed, and the whole bed is just covered with a mass of undulating roaches. I thought that was just really terrific.
Mm. One of my concerns would be, if I were doing a movie like this, is what happens to the roaches after the shoot? You have 22,000 roaches running around a set. I mean, who'd want 22,000 roaches, not only in the set, but added to the city that it's being filmed in? Is there any way to ensure that you can gather them all up and control them when you're finished?
Well, the government regulations that I had with the permit stated that all the imported roaches had to be frozen and then burned, which is what we did. It was a wonderful job, by the way. It wasn't one that I was particularly happy to do. I don't like to kill animals. I really don't. But it was the only way. We just had too many of them to deal with.
Are there any ethical questions that you run into in your line of work, since you must get asked to do very unusual things with insects?
In my mind, I don't like to kill any insect unless I absolutely have to. And frequently, I did a shoot just with live bees recently, and I returned those bees to the wild. And I did The Believers, and there was a scene in The Believers where I had to pick up a live centipede and run a pin through it. And I had a very hard time deciding whether I would do it. And I finally did a little bit of research into the anatomy of the insect and the physiology of the insect. It's not an insect, I'm sorry, it's an arachnid. And I decided that I could do it, and the animal would survive. And I did it. And as a matter of fact, we had to do that take twice, and the animal is still alive at the museum, in my office at the museum. So the research there paid off. But I don't think I would do it again. I really don't. It really disturbed me. I mean, the scene was dynamite in the movie. It was a very nice scene, but it really bothered me to do it.
What bothers you is the thought of torturing insects.
That's right. I don't like to do that at all.
Well, one of the most shocking moments in recent entertainment television was when the magicians Penn and Teller appeared on the David Letterman show, and Letterman said, "I want you to really surprise me." So Teller put his magician's hat on Letterman's desk, then lifted it up a little bit later to reveal hundreds of roaches, which immediately took over Letterman's desk. Letterman was absolutely horrified, or at least that's how
he sure was.
He appeared to be. Now, you were the wrangler that Penn and Teller used to get those roaches. When they called you up and asked you to surprise David Letterman live on television, what did you think of the idea?
Well, it was a matter of getting Penn and Teller to learn to handle the insects, and they did that pretty well. When it came to the final roundup, they just pitched in and helped. They helped me scoop them up, which says a lot for Penn and Teller. And we got them all back except for one, which showed up the next night when Julia Child was doing some cooking, I understand. I thought that was rather amusing.
Dave Brody is senior museum technician in the Department of Entomology at the Museum of Natural History in New York. We spoke in 1987. When ants are marching across your kitchen or taking over your picnic lunch, it's unlikely that you'll pause to reflect on what fascinating creatures they are. Maybe this is a better time. Before we meet one of the world's foremost ant experts, let's hear an ant's point of view as expressed by Woody Allen in the animated film Ants.
You know, my mother never had time for me. You know, when you're the middle child in a family of 5 million, you don't get any attention. I mean, how is it possible? And I've always had these abandonment issues which plagued me. My father was basically a drone, like I've said, and, you know, the guy flew away when I was just a larva. And my job, don't get me started on, because it really annoys me. I was not cut out to be a worker, I'll tell you right now. I feel physically inadequate. My whole life, I've never been able to lift more than 10 times my own body weight. And when you get down to it, handling dirt is not my idea of a rewarding career. It's this whole gung-ho superorganism thing that I, you know, I can't get. I try, but I don't get it. I mean, you know, what is it? I'm supposed to do everything for the colony. And what about my needs? What about me?
Woody Allen from the film Ants. Edward O. Wilson knows all about ants. He won his second Pulitzer Prize for his 1990 book, The Ants. Wilson is a professor at Harvard, an honorary curator in entomology at Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. I spoke to him in 1994 after the publication of Journey to the Ants. In your new book, Journey to the Ants, you have these fantastic blown-up photographs of ants. This is how ants look, I guess, under a microscope, you know, if you enlarge them thousands of times. And in these enlarged photographs, the ants look a lot, to me anyways, like dinosaurs. They have dinosaur-type faces, and their little antennae look like horns coming out of the head. They look quite prehistoric to me. And in fact, the ants date back to the dinosaur era. So is that why they look the way they do?
Well, it's not their great age. I think it's the fact that they have external skeletons. We are typical mammals in that we have an internal skeleton, and our tissues right out to our thin, soft skin are added like padding onto that internal skeletal structure. But insects, including ants, have it the other way around. They have their skeleton on the outside, and they have all that soft tissue on the inside. And having the hard body parts on the outside means that they build spines and plates and horns and medieval armor-like joints all over the body that does give them that dinosaur look. In fact, they're much more extreme in that regard than our dinosaurs.
I want to see ants a little more through your eyes. A lot of people see ants as just, you know, pests that attack your food when you're on a picnic or that infest your house, much to your dismay. What do the ants do that are wonderful within the larger ecosystem?
Let me introduce that by telling you the answer to the question that I most often ask about ants, and that is, what do I do about the ones in my kitchen? And my answer is always the same. Watch where you step. Be careful of little lives. Put down a little bit of cookie crumbs for them, maybe a touch of whipped cream. They like that too. And watch them for a while, and you will see a world that is as different from our own as can be imagined. It is a world of the kind that one might expect if life had been found on Mars, or as we may indeed find it on some other planet. Ants belong to an evolutionary line that diverged from our own half a billion years ago, and they achieved numerous adaptations to the world, including their social organization in a way that's radically different from our own. So look at them as inhabitants, if you will, as another planet. And this difference includes, to come quickly to the point of what I see in them as a scientist who works on them, includes their near total reliance on chemical communication. And here they are really radically different from us. We are audio-visual creatures. We should realize that our dependence on sound and sight to get through the world and to communicate with one another is really rather exceptional in the animal world, and the ants are much more typical in being chemical. That is to say, they release substances, chemicals, secretions from all over their bodies. They have special glands for this purpose that then they pass back and forth. They taste, they smell, and is with different chemicals that they actually are able to communicate with one another rapidly and in a sophisticated manner. For example, there are chemicals they release to alarm one another, saying there is an enemy near.
My guest is entomologist E. O. Wilson. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about ants with entomologist Edward O. Wilson.
You did an experiment on the chemical an ant gives off when the ant has died that communicates to the other ants that the ant is dead and needs to be carried out of the ant nest. Tell us about the experiment.
When an ant dies, just like any other dead thing, it crumples up. It may be lying on its back, but it's not noticed by the other ants rushing by it inside the nest as we would notice it because we're visual. And the ants in the nest wait until the corpse begins to decay. And after 2 or 3 days, it's full of substances that you find in a corpse. You know, all of these unpleasant things like trimethylamine and skatol and fatty acids and so on. And it occurred to me, we're talking back in the 50s during the early days of working out the chemical language of ants, it occurred to me that ants probably having small brains, not being able to process very much information, depended not on all that array of charnel house smells, but probably zeroed in on a distinctive smell, and so it proved. I got this in synthetic form, many of the chemicals that are found in corpses. My laboratory was unbearable to visitors for weeks during those experiments, and I tried them one out after the other on ants that I had in the laboratory, and finally hit upon the astonishing discovery that indeed ants identify a corpse with oleic acid. When you daub oleic acid, pure oleic acid, on a piece of paper or a live ant from that nest, it's treated as a corpse. And I amused myself and students for years afterward by putting oleic acid on live ants and watching them be picked up by their nest mates and just carried out and dumped on the refuse pile where corpses are placed. And then the ants had to, of course, pick themselves up and try to clean themselves off and get back into work inside the nest. But if they didn't get enough of that oleic acid off, then they would be picked up and dumped in the corpse pile again. And this kept on until finally they got clean enough to rejoin the living. That's sort of the night of the living dead.
No, were you able to analyze whether the living dead ants could do anything to protest being carried off?
Nothing whatsoever, because you see, there's nothing in the natural world that adds something like oleic acid to the body of ants. And ants are magnificently programmed to do certain things with great efficiency and speed, but there are many things they're not programmed to do because there's never been any occasion in their evolution for them to do it. And therefore, you can play tricks on ants. One of my favorite is to take a trail substance, which I first discovered back in the late 50s, in different kinds of ants. These are the substances that the ants lay down from particular glands in the rear part of their body, and the worker going outside the nest and finds a piece of food or a good place to build a new nest will lay a trail consisting of the material from that gland back to the nest. So once I discovered what that substance was and the gland was coming from, then I could bring the ants out anytime I wanted and take them anywhere I wanted. And in one extreme experiment I did, I led a group of slave-making ants. These are ants that specialize on enslaving other kinds of ants and living off their labor. And I actually brought out armies of slave-making ants and had them milling around at the end of my artificial trail in confusion, wondering where the war was, where the battle was. They were brought out, and they didn't have any colony to attack and enslave.
You could make yourself a cult leader in the ant world.
Yes, indeed. It's possible, I think, with 20 or 30 substances, the key ones that the ants use to communicate chemically with, to have complete mind control of an ant colony. Let that be a lesson to us.
Well, really, say instead of being a brilliant scientist, you had a sick and perverse mind. I mean, you could use these ants for all kinds of unusual purposes, no?
Well, probably not, because most ant colonies are are really rather delicate constructions, and they may seem annoying and ineradicable when they're living in the walls of your house, but when you start altering them a little bit, put them in a wrong environment, or are messing up their communication system with trials of the kind that I've conducted, then the colony falls apart rather quickly.
What would happen to the world if all the ants were to magically disappear?
Terrible things. Let me preface my response by saying that, of course, we will do everything in our power to save the human species. That is the entire meaning of our own lives. But if the human species were to disappear from the Earth would go on unperturbed. In fact, the ecosystems of the world would regain their previous equilibrium, and short of some great meteorite strike, the planet could count on another billion years or so of undisturbed evolution amidst great biological diversity. But if ants, these little despised creatures at our feet, were to disappear, because they are such vital parts of the ecosystem on which the turning of the soil and the removal of dead animals and the predation on other kind of animals and so on is vital. If they were removed, then we would see a partial collapse of the ecosystems on the land. Probably many thousands of other species would become extinct soon afterward. Many plants would go extinct and so on. There would be a major reorganization and a depauperization of the land ecosystems. The world would suffer if it lost an important group like the ants.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for the privilege.
Edward O. Wilson recorded in 1994 after the publication of his book Journey to the Ants. More creepy creatures in the second half of the show as Animal Week continues. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Ah! Hey! Tell me what you're gonna do about that. Tell me what you're gonna do. I got to know about that. Did you love for real? Do you know how I feel? Tell me what you're gonna do. Yeah, about that. I got ants in my pants and I need to dance. Come on. Mama, come and give me a chance. Hey, hey, hey. Got ants in my pants and I need to dance. Come on. Hey, hey. You need someone to love you. I'm the one. I'm a good, fine, loving son of a gun. Come on. Hey. Do ya? Do ya? I love you, yes I do, with all my heart and soul. I need you, yes I do. Don't let my love go cold. Squeeze me tight, hold me right, make me know you're mine. Need you, open lights, yes I always find. I love you, I want you, with all my heart and soul. I need you, yes I do. Don't let my love go cold.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
coming up, Animal Week continues with more creepy creatures. Snake expert Harry Green tells us how snakes inject their venom. Then Wayne Grady explains how vultures manage to eat dead and decomposing flesh without getting sick. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our Animal Week continues with a look at one of the creatures you probably fear most. It's the creature my guest is obsessed with, the snake. There are 2,700 species of snakes. Harry Green is particularly interested in the venomous ones. He travels around the world studying the behavior of serpents. He tracks them by surgically implanting small radios, then monitoring their transmissions. He's done field work in Europe, Africa, Latin America, the West Indies, and the United States. He's curator of herpetology in the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology at the University of California, Berkeley. And he's the author of the book, Snakes, The Evolution of Mystery in Nature. I spoke with him in 1997. Just before we turned the tape on, Green asked me what I thought of snakes. A logical question for him to ask, I thought. But next he asked me what I thought of spiders. I couldn't figure out why he wanted to know.
I ask you about the spiders because it turns out to be the case that a fair number of people who like snakes are arachnophobic. They're afraid of spiders, at least mildly so.
People who probably like snakes are afraid of spiders?
The most famous person is probably E.O. Wilson, whom you've probably talked to before.
I have, yeah.
Yeah, he admits to being mildly arachnophobic, and I am also, and I have no idea why these two things are coupled.
Wait, you're afraid of spiders?
I'm uneasy about them. And I don't like being surprised by them.
Even ones that aren't poisonous?
Well, I think all spiders are venomous in a sense that they have these little fangs and venom and so forth. It's just that only some of them affect people. But yes, even the ones that aren't dangerous to people give me the willies.
That's really interesting because so many people get the willies from snakes, and you love snakes.
That's right. I would handle large venomous snakes all day long before I'd pick up a tarantula.
Huh. What is it could you figure it out?
I have no idea. It's very strange because I've never been afraid of snakes since I was a small child, and I've always been uneasy about spiders.
Huh.
You know, we know that the whole thing about snakes is very complicated, that it's likely that people have sort of a learning bias, an innate learning bias to be afraid of snakes, and yet that bias can be easily reversed or reinforced by early experience with your parents, your classmates, and so forth. And perhaps spiders are the same way.
Now, I know you're particularly interested in venomous snakes, so before we get any further, let me hit you with the question that I'm sure everyone wants to hear, which is, have you been bitten?
Ah, that's an embarrassing question because I wish I could say I'd never been bitten, but I was bitten once by a not very big copperhead when I was a teenager, and it was not a serious bite. I was measuring the copperhead in my garage laboratory. I was 17 years old, and I was watching the tail tip next to the yardstick more carefully than I was watching the head. And the snake managed to get one fang out the side of its mouth and poke me in the thumb.
What's the most dangerous snake that you've handled?
The most dangerous snake I've handled is called a terciopelo in Costa Rica. A lot of people know it as a fertilance. It's a very large pit viper. Reaches a length of maybe 7 feet or more. and has very long fangs, very powerful venom, fairly prone to bite.
And what do you do when you handle it? What's the best way to handle it?
Well, actually, I should tell you, I've tried to get away from actually handling venomous snakes. When I started out in herpetology, it was common to handle venomous snakes by holding their head down with a metal hook and then picking them up carefully between your finger and your thumb. And when I started going to meetings of herpetologists, people that study reptiles and amphibians, it was not uncommon to encounter something we called the herpetologist handshake, which was a missing finger or a finger that looked like it had been in a pencil sharpener or even a large mass of scar tissue in the palm. And that's not very common now, and I think the main reason is that we've tried to get away from that. And I've picked up many venomous snakes with my bare hands before, and I try to not do it anymore. The way we do it is to use a plexiglass tube that's a little bit larger in diameter than the snake, and then with our snake hook, we coax the venomous snake to crawl partway up into the plexiglass tube so it's essentially muzzled. And then you can just pick it up right where the snake goes into the tube and hold it so it can't move forward or backward. Can you sort of visualize what
Absolutely,
I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's great because it doesn't traumatize the snakes as much. It turned out that this mashing of the head down on the ground with enough force that you could safely restrain the snakes probably pretty hard on the animal. And they really freak out. They start thrashing around trying to break free and trying to bite. And if you run them up this plexiglass tube, they obviously feel restrained and usually struggle a little bit, but they don't just start flipping about and thrashing and trying to bite. So it's both more humane and much safer for us.
You are particularly interested in venomous snakes. Why do snakes have venom?
Well, what we know is that snakes use venom for various things. Probably all venomous snakes are using their venom to subdue prey. And maybe you know that snakes have this capacity to just eat enormous meals. And in the case of venomous snakes, they can eat meals up to about 1.5 times their body weight. So here I am, 170-pound male, think in terms of me being able to eat a 210, 215-pound hamburger in 20 minutes without chopping it into pieces. Now, they can only do that because they can subdue that meal. You know, I couldn't subdue a 220-pound cow and then swallow it whole, you know, without knife, fork, implements, and so on. So the first thing venom does probably is it lets them subdue things. The other probably really important role it often plays is to help them digest things. So when this rattlesnake is sitting next to a rat runway and the rat comes by and the snake out of hiding strikes it for just an instant and with these hypodermic needle-like fangs injects this venom into the rat and then lets go, the rat goes bounding off. And as the rat goes bounding down the side of the canyon, its own heartbeats are circulating the digestive enzymes that are in the snake's venom. In the meantime, the snake starts crawling along, tracking the rat, following its chemical trail. And the snake can distinguish between the trail of a bitten rat and an unbitten rat. Within a few minutes, it locates the rat, which is by now dead and by now is already being digested from the inside out. So those are probably the two main roles, are to subdue really big prey and to help digest this really big item that's soon going to be stuck in their stomach. Of course, there's an obvious third use, which is that many venomous snakes defend themselves with their venom.
You've probably spent a lot of time watching snakes eat their prey.
Yep.
How long does it take for the rodent that the snake has ingested whole to stop being a big bulge in the body of the snake?
You can watch it go down day by day, but say it was a snake that ate something approaching its own body weight, it might take it in the wild something like a week to 10 days to digest it. In fact, once with my radios, I found a female blacktail rattlesnake in the fall when it was quite chilly. I walked up to her with my antenna and my receiver and locator, and she had eaten what I think was a brush rabbit that probably weighed more than she did and was so big that she couldn't coil, and I don't think she could move. And so, of course, I become somewhat attached to these animals, having captured them and anesthetized them and put a radio in them. So my first thought was, oh, no, she's going to explode. It's cold, and you know, and we have a lot of predators at our study site. Maybe one's going to catch her. But each day I would come out and relocate her, and each day the bulge would be a little smaller. And after 9 days, she crawled up the canyon, went into hibernation, having eaten what was maybe a third of her energy budget for the whole year in this one feeding event.
When you wonder what it's like to be a snake, do you wonder what it's like to have this big thing in the middle of your body after you've eaten?
That's an interesting question, because I've tried to imagine various things about being a snake, and that's one I haven't had much success sort of thinking up a metaphor or an analog for. I've tried to imagine what it's like to slither, and mm-hmm. I can't come very close to that. I've tried to imagine what it would be like to literally walk my head over an object bigger than me and have my whole stomach stretched around it, and I can't empathize with that very well. I've tried to think about what it would like to be to live in a chemical realm. In other words, if somehow smell for us could have the texture and nuance that vision does, what would that be like?
Is that the realm the snake lives in?
That's pretty much the realm a snake lives in. They have eyes and they can see, but there's just no question that chemosensation, which is what that forked tongue is for, is preeminent in the lives of most snakes. And the closest I've come, I've tried to imagine odor experiences for humans where it has subliminal effects on us, you know, where it has effects that we don't even think about. And one of them would be like, have you ever been driving down the highway and you happen to pass by a bakery?
Yeah.
And so suddenly it comes in your car window, the smell of fresh baked bread or yeast rolls. And, you know, you, just almost before you think about it, you just start imagining right out of the oven yeast rolls with butter on them or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's in the direction of what it would be like to be a snake. Probably a more powerful example would be if you've ever noticed the odors you can smell in a landscape that you like after it rains.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, that's a very hopeful, happy feeling to be driving along in the Sonoran Desert, for example, and smell the creosote odors and so forth right after rain. I think before I consciously think about what does that mean, I'm already feeling sort of exhilarated and optimistic because of it. And I think that being a snake must be like that in the chemical world, except a lot more.
My guest is herpetologist Harry Green. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Harry Green, author of Snakes, The Evolution of Mystery in Nature. So what species of snakes are you most involved studying now?
For the past several years, I've been working in Arizona and mostly working on rattlesnakes, and particularly something called the black-tailed rattlesnake, which is a really beautiful yellow and diamond-patterned animal with a jet black tail and sort of a black mask through the eyes. Looks sort of like Indian beadwork.
Hmm. Why do rattlers rattle?
To scare people away, to scare adversaries away. And that's virtually the only reason. The rattle doesn't rattle. They don't rattle, for example, when they're trying to catch prey or when they're courting, times like that. In fact, the only time I ever hear the rattle, other than when the snake is upset, is that the courtship involves the male sort of poking around the female's tail with his tail. And often for the first several hours and even several days of a courtship encounter, the female kind of keeps the male at bay. He follows her around just for hours and rubs her back and tongue flicks her back and so forth. And every few minutes he tries to lift her tail with his so he can mate with her. And at that stage, she slaps him away with her tail and it makes a clanking sound to the rattles, not a loud buzzing like you get when they're defending themselves. So sometimes when I'm sitting and watching a courting pair and they disappear in the vegetation, I can't see them well, I'll know exactly what stage the courtship is at when I hear this clack, 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 and I know that she's just slapped him away and the whole thing's starting over.
Hmm. And how dangerous is the rattlesnake's bite?
Well, you know, it turns out we don't have real good statistics on snake bite in this country. Probably many snake bites, perhaps even some snake bite deaths, go unreported, but people have guessed in the neighborhood of 2,000 bites a year from all venomous snakes in this country, and maybe 10 deaths a year in the whole United States. And it turns out we know now pretty much what causes death. So if you actually were to die from rattlesnake bite, it would probably be because you went into shock from having your blood circulatory system damaged. And that's preventable in a hospital situation. So the bottom line is that basically you shouldn't die from a snake bite in this country with proper medical care.
If you had a friend who was bit by a snake, would you try to make an incision and suck out the venom like we see in old cowboy movies?
Well, I wouldn't make an incision. I don't think anybody recommends that anymore for a couple of reasons. One is we were always recommending that people stay calm, and I don't know why we didn't stop to think that you're not very likely to be calm if somebody's whacking away at your finger with a dull Swiss Army knife. You know, I mean, that's sort of guaranteed to make you not calm. And the other thing is there's a fairly serious danger that you would cut a nerve or a tendon or a blood vessel and actually cause something much more serious than the snake bite in terms of permanent injury. There are snake bite kits that act as suction devices, and there's a possibility that they do some good. So physicians I've worked with do recommend using those suction devices if they're conveniently available immediately. But the most important thing is just to keep the victim calm and get them to a medical facility.
You explained before that part of what the snake venom does to the snake's prey is predigest it.
Mm-hmm.
So like a mouse, for instance, would start getting digested from the inside out before the snake has even had a chance to swallow it.
That's right.
Do humans get predigested by snake venom when they're bit?
That's right. So if you were to get bitten by a good-sized rattlesnake in the hand, within a couple of hours, probably your whole forearm would be swollen. Certainly by the next day, your entire arm would be twice its normal diameter. So actually, it's pretty gross. I mean, if you got bitten by a big viper, within a day or two, your arm or hand would basically look like it had been barbecued.
Harry Green is the author of Snakes, The Evolution of Mystery in Nature. In those old westerns, if a cowboy is bitten by a rattlesnake and dies, there's going to be vultures circling overhead. People are seldom happy to see vultures. In the Bible, they were called an abomination. Charles Darwin described the turkey vulture as a disgusting bird with its bald scarlet head formed to wallow in putridity. In art and literature, vultures are always the harbingers of imminent demise. Nature writer Wayne Grady points all this out in the beginning of his book, Vulture, Nature's Ghastly Gourmet. But he spends the rest of the book trying to undo the bad press vultures have received. The book is filled with information that is as fascinating as it is unappetizing. I asked him first about the place of the vulture in mythology and popular culture.
In Europe, certainly, and in India, the bird is in a lot of the early mythology of India. They're known as the gatekeepers of hell because they, for obvious reasons, I guess, I mean, they deal with death and dead things, and so it's natural to associate them with death and hell. In India, for the past 1,500 years or more, there's been a regular ritual ceremony in which dead bodies are exposed on mountaintops to vultures who come and eat them. It's called a sky burial. It's a rather gruesome ritual, but it's been part of the mythology for centuries.
I'm going to stop you right there. I don't know if you saw the movie Kundun, the Martin Scorsese movie.
Yes.
about the Dalai Lama, but there's a scene at a Tibetan monastery,
mm-hmm.
in which one of the monks dies, and the monk is basically, his body is basically chopped up into smaller pieces and left for the vultures to eat.
Yes, that's the sky burial, and that takes place still today. I mean, it happens every day but Sunday, apparently, and the bodies are chopped up and ground up into small pieces. The bones are broken up and mixed with yak milk, I think, so that every part of the body is consumed by hordes of vultures that come down and hang around the area for that particular purpose.
Is that a way? What is the point of that sky burial?
I think the two things. I mean, there's the philosophical point, which is sort of becoming one with nature when you die. It's exactly the same as being buried in North America or Europe. You know, the body is decomposed and made to become one with the earth. In this case, with a creature of the earth. But the practical, I think, application in Tibet is that there's no soil up there. There aren't 6 feet of soil at the top of the mountaintops. So that it's a way of disposing of corpses without causing disease.
Vultures eat putrid, decaying corpses that no other animal would go near. I mean, other animals would get sick if they ate this. How come vultures don't get sick when they eat putrid corpses?
Well, they have some kind of, I don't really know the science of this, but they have some kind of special juices in their intestinal tract that kills bacteria. I think people should be studying whatever it is inside a vulture that kills things like anthrax, for example. There's a lot of talk about anthrax in the news these days, and weapons-grade anthrax. There isn't any real antidote to anthrax. If a human comes down with that disease, there aren't too many things you can take to counteract the bacterial infection, but somehow the vulture has something in its gut that kills anthrax, and we should probably be taking a look at it. Yeah.
This kind of gives them the edge, huh, when it comes to getting food.
Well,
because they don't have a lot of competition in eating this stuff.
Well, that's right. There's a real niche there for them. A lot of things do eat dead animals, but there aren't very many things that eat exclusively dead animals. For a vulture, the deader the better. And they have to have some kind of internal system for eating that stuff without getting sick.
My guest is nature writer Wayne Grady. We'll talk more about vultures after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Wayne Grady, author of Vulture, Nature's Ghastly Gourmet. Would you describe how the vulture is physically designed to be able to eat dead animals?
Well, the most obvious thing is the naked head and neck. One of the species, the turkey vulture, is so-called because, like a turkey or like a flamingo, it has no feathers on its neck or on its head. Makes it look kind of weird as a bird. We're used to seeing birds covered all over in feathers, but vultures have no feathers from the shoulder up, and that's an adaptation to the kinds of the way they eat. I mean, they stick their heads into rather horrible places, and they can sort of pull their heads out without bringing a lot of gore and stuff attached to their feathers. And we mentioned the stomach juices that are able to digest bacteria. Their feet are not adapted to grasping. As for a long time, vultures were thought to be members of the same family as hawks and owls and eagles and things. But unlike those other raptors, vultures cannot grasp onto a carcass and fly off with it. Their feet are particularly useful for tearing and rending, but not for carrying. So they have to stay pretty much where the carcass is, where they find the carcass. They don't take it home with them as other raptors do.
Is it coincidence that some of them are colored like blood and guts?
Yes, it's probably coincidence. The coloration is probably more for sexual display than to remind them of what they eat.
Kind of sex and violence thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, it's fascinating to read that vultures have no voice box, so this is a bird without a song.
It's a bird without a song, and a bird with a sense of smell. So the two unusual bird-like qualities there. Yeah, they don't have a voice box. They can click at one another, and they do that during the mating ritual. But they don't squawk or cry or sing or anything like that other birds do.
How do vultures find the dead and dying corpses that they feed on?
Well, two things. Turkey vultures and greater yellow-headed vultures have a sense of smell. And they're one of the very few, probably two or three other species of birds in the bird kingdom have a sense of smell. And very, very highly developed. A turkey vulture can smell a rotting corpse from 1,000 feet in the air. And they sort of cruise in the forests, in the forest canopy and in the open savannas, waiting to sort of catch a whiff of something. In fact, I read somewhere that natural gas line repairmen look for circling turkey vultures over a part of the territory where they know that there's a leak in the gas line, and because natural gas smells like rotting food, turkey vultures are often fooled by a gas leak. So line repairmen will look for circling vultures to tell them where there's a possible leak in the line. And other vultures who have not developed a sense of smell will follow the turkey vultures or the yellow-headed vultures to a corpse. So you might sometimes get a situation where there's sort of three different species of vultures circling over an area, two of the species watching the turkey vulture to come down, and then as soon as they see a turkey vulture go down, they'll go down and sort of bump the turkey vulture off the carcass and take over. There's a very strict hierarchy of feeding in vulture land.
Do you find vultures beautiful?
Oh yeah, I do. I didn't when I started working on this book. I must confess, I was not one of the vultures' big fans until I really sort of got to know from reading and talking to researchers and observing myself, got to know that they were actually a very interesting bird, very unique. Have unique problems and have found unique solutions to the problems. I find them sort of, I guess, intellectually beautiful. Some of them are actually quite physically beautiful. I mentioned the king vulture earlier. The turkey vulture with its bright red head and neck is quite nice looking too. I quite like birds. I'm an amateur birder and spend a lot of time watching birds, and if you spend any time at all watching vultures in the air, particularly, you'll have to admit that they're an absolute beautiful animal to watch. The way they circle on the airways, you know, the warm air thermals, they just glide. And they can glide up there for hours with hardly ever moving a wing to propel themselves. They just sort of ride those thermals. They have extraordinarily large wingspan for the body weight, so they can hang glide for literally hours and hours, traveling hundreds and hundreds of kilometers with maybe flapping their wings two or three times.
Wayne Grady is the author of Vulture, Nature's Ghastly Gourmet. Our Animal Week series is produced by Kathy Wolf. Our senior producer today was Roberta Schurach. Chris Fraley was our engineer. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Ow! Who's that I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood, you sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want. Listen to me, Little Red Riding Hood, I don't think little big girls should go walking in these spooky old woods alone. Sheep suit on until I'm sure that you've been shown that I can be trusted walking with you alone. Oh, Little Red Riding Hood, I'd like to hold you if I could, but you might think I'm a big bad wolf, so I won't. Better to love you with Little Red Riding Hood.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.